They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Joining me on the Commons today is John Cowherd. As John said to me a few minutes ago when we were sitting here, he said, you know, there's a whole lot going on. For those of you who don't know John, he's got a blog. We'll talk about it. And also, he is an attorney, one of the few attorneys in Northern Virginia who represents just the homeowners. So, John, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about your blog, because you've got some interesting stuff, and we're going to talk about some of that stuff.
Thank you, Shu. It's great to be back and to be on your show. I always enjoy our conversations. I almost feel like I would come in here and we could just talk, even though we're not recording, and it would be a worthwhile visit to the studio. My blog is called Words of Conveyance. It's a website that is focused on Virginia construction and real estate law, with an emphasis on a number of things, such as the rights of property owners in homeowners associations and condominiums, neighbor disputes, real estate foreclosure, litigation, and construction project disputes. And I named the blog Words of Conveyance after the words of conveyance are the language in a deed that it's the magic language in the deed that's operative, that causes the property to be transferred from the seller to the buyer, the grantor to the grantee. And I just thought that was a great title for a real estate blog, because
it is.
You know, real estate is not just about the technical aspects or the financial aspects of real estate. It's about people, and real estate law, law practice is about communication. It's about understanding the relationships that exist between neighboring property owners, between association boards and owners, between contractors and their clients, and so on. And that's what my law practice is all about.
One of the things that you wrote, I mean, your latest blog that came out, is something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that's the total imbalance that we have between owners and associations in HOAs. An association has these enormous, it seems like unlimited powers and unlimited ability to enforce contracts, whereas the homeowner has relatively few options, and certainly nothing that's not very expensive and is loaded with risk. But an association can say, well, you breached the terms of our contract, and therefore we're going to fine you. And if you don't pay the fine, we can foreclose and take your house away from you.
Well, that's a pretty good summary, although I would cherry-pick out of your statement.
Go ahead.
The,
Go ahead.
The fact that you said the HOA has seemingly unlimited powers to do these things, and I think that, the word seemingly is important because those powers are not unlimited, they're not absolute. They just, the boards and their retinue just act like they are.
But the thing is, to prevent them, first of all, you have to get a degree in real estate law to understand what your rights are. Then you have to find an attorney. And you're one of a handful across the country that I know of. So many attorneys who practice law don't really understand this area of the law. And it's up to the homeowner then to go and do their homework, find an attorney to represent them, go to court and say to the board, hey, wait a minute, board, you're acting outside the scope of your authority. Heaven forbid the CAI-affiliated attorneys would ever tell a board you can't do that. It's like, yeah, go ahead, do it, see what happens.
Well, your client is your boss, ultimately, and the client pays your bills, and if you...
So there's a conflict of interest there?
Well,
massive
it's,
one,
it's
huh?
hard to, sometimes for many attorneys, it can be hard to tell them that they can't do something. And then in many cases, especially in the community associations context, there's, you know, you can't do that because there's no statutory or contractual authority to do what you want to do. And then there's a separate question of, you know, if we do this, can we get away with it 9 out of 10 times because people are either ignorant or broke or so angry that they can't kind of fit together the details or confused or we, you know, for whatever reason, they're not going to fight it. So maybe we have to defend a case or two every now and then. But it doesn't make sense to kind of do things by the book, so to speak, in every case because, you know, what's the consequence? You're just kind of running a risk of having to make an insurance claim that you might not otherwise have to make.
Here's the risk, John. I talked to some of the CAI attorneys, and we've gone back and forth. I mean, some of them I really like, and they're very, very nice, and one of them, and I can't remember, a number of years ago, I mean, these guys have paved the way for associations to do exactly this kind of stuff. And one of them said to me, you know, my parents moved to, well, I don't know, I can't remember, and they moved into an HOA. And they had problems, and they had to get an attorney. Now, their parents are suffering because of some of the stuff that they have done. And those are the consequences. If you want to be fair, you know, you don't create situations that sort of go right across the country, strip people of their rights, put them at a disadvantage, and then say, oops, you know, maybe we'll have to. It just doesn't work. I mean, you've got to have a bigger picture. You've got to think down the road.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, what I like about this show and about some of the other educational things that are going on out there on the internet and elsewhere is that there's just such widespread ignorance about what community associations law allows and what it doesn't, what covenants say and what they don't. I mean, in your tip, I mean, I would say just from experience that typically the board has no clue as to what is happening. They've never read the governing documents. They don't even know what the difference is between bylaws and declarations and rules and regulations are.
Right.
They don't understand that it's not simply what it says, it's what it means under the law of whatever state you're dealing with. And they've never read the Property Owners Association Act or the Condominium Act or any of these things. And so it's the same, it's commonly the same with many owners. And And in this kind of environment, you know, when people, when interpersonal disputes start erupting between owners and the property managers or owners and the boards or different factions in the board, people get really upset and they become very passionate about it. And it's difficult to listen to someone who's read the governing documents and understand what they mean and what remedies may or may not be available in court. It's difficult to listen to them because it's just so, you know, it's your
They're
house.
Passionate. They're
it's
passionate.
It's either your house or it's your pride of ownership towards your director, the work you're doing as a director or as a property manager or an attorney. And, you know, this is just very human stuff.
So why have we created these monstrosities? I mean, we've created these. Let's face it.
Well, I mean, let's just talk a little bit about fines and assessments and fines and liens and foreclosures to understand kind of how we got here and what it means and what would it mean if these things were gone? We're no longer a part of the landscape. In real estate law, when you go to court, and courts are, under our constitutional system, courts have the authority to enforce contracts and property rights. That's the power they've been delegated by the Constitution of Virginia or whatever state you're talking about. Yes, and so the only way that can be limited is by people kind of agreeing to have that limited by entering into some kind of contract for arbitration or some kind of other dispute resolution. In property law, there are a number of different types of remedies that the courts will consider. The courts will consider giving you money damages, an award of saying that the other side owes you money because of something. They can award a party possession of the property, like in an eviction. Or lastly, and which I think is the most interesting remedy, is called an injunction. An injunction is a very special kind of property law remedy, because in an injunction, the judge is telling a party either that you have to do something or you are forbidden from doing something. And that's a very different kind of remedy than saying, okay, well, I'm going to let the sheriffs go out and give this property to somebody else, or I'm going to say if you don't pay this money judgment, then someone can file garnishments or something like that. Telling someone they have to do something under penalty of a possible later contempt proceeding, it's a very serious thing. And traditionally, that's what property owners would have. If, let's say, you did whatever property-oriented violation you could think of, whether it's painting your garage door purple, using your backyard as a landfill, a private landfill next to a common area, or name anything.
I'm going to tell you, because you've reminded me of this, but at a later point, I'm going to tell you the story about one of the townhouses in my development in Lake Braddock in Burke, Virginia, that happened many, many moons ago, that I discovered when I was running for the board, and I wanted to know what I was getting into and what our rights were. And it seems that there's a whole story that went along with this. And one of the cases that I found in court was this young couple who bought a townhouse and hired their friend to paint an apple tree above the front door. And of course, everybody went, you can't do that. So they went to court, because there was no such thing as fines in those days. And they said, look at this. And the homeowner said, here are the governing documents. Here's the declaration. It says that anybody in a single-family home may not alter the front of that, may not paint the house for a period of 4 years. This was while the developer was still there. But there's not a word about painting or colors or anything at all in the townhouse section. And the judge agreed with them and said that, you know what, you don't have the authority to enforce this. So there's a falling out between the homeowners and the friend for a number of reasons. So he never finished the apple tree. It ended up looking like what was commonly called, dubbed the witch's tree in Lake Braddock. But the courts upheld the homeowner's right to have that because the contract did not specify that they couldn't do that.
Right, right.
So it was a short case. It was, they've done this, judge, tell them to undo it. Homeowner said they don't have the authority. It was over and done.
Right, right. That sounds like a result that you would expect when a board does not have the authority to just simply fine someone for something. But those kinds of cases, those injunction cases, are tough. There are many legal requirements for obtaining an injunction. Most of those requirements are buried in old cases from 1847 or 1905, where people had kind of fought things out and maybe brought them up to the Supreme Court of Virginia. And so a lot of these requirements aren't things that are codified in the Property Owners Association Act or anywhere in the Code of Virginia. They're just part of our legal heritage that have the force of law, but sometimes you don't really know which bullet points the judge is going to emphasize until you get in there and you start putting on evidence.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, let's say you get an injunction to order someone to whitewash over the witch's tree or clean out the private landfill or whatever it is, stop flooding my property, then what? It's a piece of paper that's in the courthouse in a file someplace. The judge doesn't get off his bench and go out there and stand over someone while they're forced to correct something. The sheriff's office doesn't go out there and whitewash it, or the police, or anyone. It's just an order that says, you know, you Shue Bartholomew, are going to,
right.
You know, you're either going to paint the witch's tree or you're going to whitewash over it or whatever it is. And then if the order is not complied with, then the case could be appealed and a bond could be required. The whole process can drag on for months, if not years. And in the end of the day, if the other side doesn't comply with the order, then you might be dragged back into court. The parties might end up back in court over a contempt proceeding where they're asking for, let's say, $100 a day for every day that the witch's tree remains on the front above the front door of the townhouse. And that's when you start getting these quote-unquote fines for non-compliance. That's when that process enters into the equation under the old, under the old way where you don't have the Property Owners Association Act with all these fast-track superhighway gimmicks.
So, but then you have a judge who's actually doing the fining, and that's a third person. It's not the board member or the manager who decides that they don't like the witch's tree, and it's, I mean, it is an adversarial situation, but it's the judge who says, yeah, you're right, board, this homeowner has violated the rules, and therefore I'm going to fine this homeowner. But what we have with this super slab, though, let's just zip into it, is I don't like your painting. It doesn't matter whether I have a right to like it or not, but I have been given the right to fine you because I personally am offended. It offends my aesthetic sensibilities, and away we go. And that's what I think is so, so wrong.
Right. I mean, I think it's a lot of these rights, these civil rights that we're talking about here, are very basic. We're talking about the right to what do you have to do? What does somebody have to do in order to tell you how to use your property, right? What does it take? And under without this legislation, what you're talking about is a whole process where the violation has to be properly alleged in a detailed lawsuit, and then it has to be proved at trial after lengthy proceedings with motions and things, and then it has to be enforced by some post-trial activity. And yes, that is expensive. Yes, that requires attorneys, but that the beauty of it is that I think that under that old system, people tend to leave each other alone a lot more. Mm-hmm. They're much less likely to pick a fight if it's going to be such a big hoopla to deal with. And what you have here with these fines is that you can skip all of this pleading and allegation and details and demand letters and production of documents and bringing witnesses and documents to trial and proving it and arguing cases and precedents to the judge, and you just, the board kind of sits in many ways, and it's not exactly a comparison, but in many ways like a judge and a jury in their own case, and decides whether or not they want to simply fine somebody for failing to comply with their directives. And I think something very important is lost in all of this. I think it's unfortunate that this legislation was allowed to be put in. I'm sure that when it was put in, someone stood up and said, gosh, these owners, they shouldn't have to endure all this litigation over whether or not someone should be ordered to cease some nuisance or something, or some architectural violation. All these months or years of litigation are a drain on everybody. So why don't we make things easier by just allowing this democratically elected board to enact fines? And if somebody has a question about the process, then they can file their own lawsuit challenging what's happened, and then they can get into court that way. But the problem is that instead of rights being protected, it's like you're handing the keys over to someone, to a group who may or may not be advancing your best interests and may not even have any interest at all in whether something is being handled properly or improperly. And the problem with it all is that owners do not have the right to non-judicial fines. They don't have the power to put liens on association common areas or any of these things. They can't tap into association bank accounts. They can't do a lot of things unless they go and litigate for a few months or possibly a year or more and get a judge to agree with them and to enter a final order that can be later enforced in a subsequent proceeding. So it is not
unbalanced.
It's very unbalanced. And there are a lot of people out there who will advocate strongly that fines are rarely abused and that they protect property
right.
values
yeah.
and they do this and they do that. But I mean, I think that having the courts exercise their constitutional mandate to protect due process, to protect property rights by means of due process, I think that's something that is much more effective than just giving the board these super slabs, as you mentioned, and then leaving owners with these kind of windy country dirt roads with which to try to get where they need to go.
You said you didn't know how it started in 1989 when they first enacted the Property Owners Association Act. It included a provision for fines, and I think the governor at the time was Bill Isles, and he refused to sign it into law with that provision in it because of the Gilman case. The Attorney General was Terry, and her opinion was that it was an unconstitutional delegation of power. So until they removed that provision, POA was not going to go into law. It wasn't until 2 years later when they came back and they reinserted that fining provision in there. And when we pointed out that it was unconstitutional, and I can't remember, I can see him, but I can't remember his name, the governor then said, oh, well, they can, as long as it's in the governing documents, they're allowed to do that. So you're allowed to sign away your rights. But the problem is nobody understands that. You say, okay, but you agreed to that because it's in the declaration when you bought the house. Nobody said, yes, I agree to give out that right.
Right.
Nobody says I gave up the right to free speech, yet they're, you know, it's being taken away from them. Just about every state there is. It's like you agreed. Nobody agreed to that. That's nonsense,
right.
John.
We've talked before about how the whole process by which the covenants, rules, and regulations, and bylaws, and everything are disclosed to the owners, and then they get it. They get 3 whole days in which to try to figure them out, and you try to hire an attorney. And what typically what happens is that they might be produced in incomplete form. The owner flips through them, doesn't understand them, and then sets them aside and focuses on other things, like, you know, ordering their moving trucks and stuff like that, and unfortunately don't look at them again until a dispute erupts over these kinds of things that we've been talking about. And I think that in my opinion, there are a lot of owner advocates out there on the internet and elsewhere who don't like this notion of covenants being something that's a contract that is interpreted according to property law and contract law. But I think really these things, property law and contract law, actually applying those doctrines to this actually protects owners. The problem is that we've got all this legislation that's been adopted that limits those rights that people had before these statutes were enacted, but people don't understand that because they just see, well, we're getting this Property Owners Association Act. Like we both have a friend who's a CAI attorney who likes to talk about how the Property Owners Association Act statute is consumer protection legislation, but really it's not. It's about overcoming all of these, all of the rules that existed before it that made covenants very difficult and cumbersome to enforce, and made it difficult to do things like bully people using fines and foreclosures and liens and things. And I would like to see certain parts of it to be repealed, such as the fine statute. I think that's a great place to start.
Oh, I agree with you. You know, I've been trying to get that done for 30 years now. But, it's got to stop. You have this notion of a contract. Unless people sit down and actually understand what they're signing, it shouldn't be a contractual. It shouldn't be treated as a contract. Even attorneys who have sat down and read every single word and have been blindsided by these contracts. So they've understood it, they've read it, they're attorneys, and it's all subject to interpretation. You get another attorney who comes along and says, no, that's not what we meant. And of course, if you get a judge that you're going to bring them more cases, the judge goes along with them. I mean, I've seen it. I've sat in court and seen it happen.
I mean, there's just a lot of things. There are a lot of rules that are, they're implied by or read into these documents by these court precedents, and unless you've worked with them over many years, you're not going to be familiar with them. You're not going to understand how they fit together. It's not fair to expect a property owner to understand all these things. It's too much.
You know, I'm thinking of Richard Alton, and I don't know if you were around or remember Richard Alton. He lives down in Richmond, and he's the guy who put a flagpole on his property in his front yard. He's an attorney, and he got the governing documents, and he read all of the restrictions in there, and it talked about compost piles. It talked about this. It talked about that. Nowhere did it say he could not have a flag on a flagpole. At no place in there. So they used, I can't remember what they used, but whatever they used to throw the flag in, and the judge went along with it. It's like, judge, what are you thinking? I mean, you know, if you're going to say, well, it's a contract and you agreed, then you better make damn sure that you have something in there about you may not have a flagpole. I mean, they just throw things in. They just interpret things any way they want to interpret them.
Well, I think one thing that's important to remember is that the purpose of having legal rights, of having court procedural protections on the books or in code books or in treatises or someplace, is not to use them. It's so that you have them so that your opponent will, if they know about it, they won't cross you on a particular point, or if they do, they'll get smacked down. So it's like the Cold War with the whole concept of deterrence, that the purpose of having legal rights is not to protect, is not so that you can go out and have litigation that lasts for months or years continually through your period of your ownership of your property. It's to have that as a right that you have, whether you know about that right or not, whether you're familiar with the details or not. It's a right that your opponent ought to know about, so that they don't do things to cross the boundary line, so to speak. And that's how you're protected. You know, you're ideally, for a lawyer, you know, lawyers like to talk about going in and, you know, getting, you know, big verdicts, or, you know, lawyers like to brag about how their opponent's an idiot and their opponent was humiliated, or they didn't like the thing that judge did, or the appeal that they won that was published in the newspaper. And yes, that's important. You know, you as an attorney, you want, you know, you need to win when you end up going to trial or going on an appeal or this or that. But the way that the legal system is supposed to work is that, by and large, people don't do things that cause them to be smacked down and humiliated and lose big in court. They don't do them because they know that they're not supposed to do them. And there's a deterrent effect that prevents people from just their whole lives being consumed by litigation. And one of the things I like to do as an attorney is, when I prepare a lawsuit, there may be a few things that I keep in my file and I don't describe in the lawsuit in the numbered paragraphs, but I like to put out there as much as I possibly can that supports my case, and I like to attach as many documents as I can to the lawsuit. I like to make sure that the legal arguments supporting the lawsuit are strong, that I've well researched it, so that when I file it, my opponent doesn't have to figure out hunt through the document and try to think and do a bunch of research to figure out whether or not I might win on maybe one out of 11 of my points, so that he has to recommend his client to settle. I want them to look at it and to immediately see, oh gosh, you know, I don't want to deal with this case. You know, Mr. Client or Mr. General Counsel of the HOA, I don't want to deal with this. I want to, you know, let's make this go away. I don't want to go before the judge on this one. I don't want to appeal this one. I don't want this one getting in the newspapers. That's you know, that's not the only aspect of lawyering, but that's a way you win without spending $1 million or ending up with some of these kind of horror stories that end up in the press that we're familiar with.
Sometimes the association attorneys will convince the association to drop the case because they don't want it to go further. They think that it's easier to lose one case than it is the ability to lose a whole lot. We've been trying to get the fining issue back into the Supreme Court. And all of the cases that we had for years, I mean, I haven't been doing a whole lot of that work lately, but initially it's like the association would always drop it. It's easier to lose one. And they'd say, you know, we're not going to move forward on this. But here's the other thing, John. There are other ways of handling things. If there's something that's really egregious, you don't have to always go to court, and you don't have to fine people, and you don't have to ridicule them, and you don't have to call them names in the newsletter, in the association newsletter. You don't have to isolate them. You don't have to mistreat them. You can always go and talk to them.
Right.
And there's always a way of getting there. I mean, use humor.
Right, that's important.
I had my neighbor who my neighbor painted his townhouse a turquoise. This color, my favorite color, and everybody in the neighborhood was up in arms. Oh my God! They showed up at the association meeting and they were yelling and screaming. I said, "Stop! You don't have the right to tell my neighbor to repaint the house." "You mean you like that?" I said, "No, I don't, but that's not the point. The point is you don't have that right." So what I did was I went to my neighbor and I said, "Hey, you got my favorite color there. It looks like a Pacific Ocean." I said, "You know what I think would look really great? I think we're going to paint some fish on the front of your house with all these bubbles going all the way up. Some tropical fish. Just add a lot of color." They looked at it. They looked at each other, and the next day they'd repainted the house. You know, but yet if the association had had their way, they'd have been all over him.
Right.
The threats and the fines and, you know, the newspaper articles and the standoffs, and you don't need that.
Right. And
Once in a while you do, but not, you normally don't need that.
I think many times people become, as I mentioned before, they just, it just touches an emotional chord with many people.
Yeah.
That sometimes people have a hard time articulating or communicating what the problem is or what their interest is in what's happening. I'm pointing at Shu across the table here. It's all like, you know, you're a bad person. You violated this rule,
yeah,
which no one has even considered whether is enforceable or not.
My
neighbor or my board member or this owner is, you know, they're a bad person because of X. But that's not, generally, that's not how you get what you want. You know, by getting angry and calling people names. I mean, it's interesting because we have this new case that came out of Florida on July 21st. I hope we have a little bit of time.
Yeah, we do.
This is the case. The owner's name here is Howard Fox, and the association is Hampton at Metro West Condominium Association. This is an appeals case that was decided July 21st of this year. So this is kind of fresh off the presses. Howard Fox owned a unit in a condominium, and he was upset with a lot of the things that were happening in his community. So he had a blog, he had social media accounts, he was out there putting out all sorts of stuff about the board and other owners that he didn't like. And the board did not like what he was doing. The Court of Appeals opinion does not describe these allegations that were put up online. I'm assuming they're not listed in this opinion because they don't want to kind of, you know, publicize whatever it was. But I mean, the listeners of your show are familiar with these kinds of blasts that you see. These kind of very very ad hominem personal attacks, yeah, about different things that happen. So the board did not like what he was doing, so they sued him, and they asked the judge to enter an injunction against Mr. Fox for violating the condominium documents because he was putting up all the scandalous stuff up on the internet. So the case continued, and at some point, Mr. Fox and his board entered into a settlement agreement where he agreed to cease doing certain things. I'm assuming, just from reading in between the lines here, that some of the stuff that he was putting up is considered to be slanderous or slander, libel, defamation, something like that. There must have been allegations that these things were false or misleading or something like that. So they signed a settlement agreement, and then the case was decided, and then later he started doing things again. He kind of got back up on the saddle, so to speak, and started posting blog posts and things and, you know, explaining to the world everything that was wrong with Hampton at Metro West condominium complex. And so, as happens in these things, he was dragged back into court to enforce the settlement agreement. But what happened here was not just simply an order that says, Mr. Fox, you are going to comply with the settlement agreement. The court went beyond that. And what they did was entering an injunction prohibiting him from communicating in any way via the internet regarding these bad things that he was, these bad observations that he had, was making about his board and about his neighbors. So this is very interesting because this contempt order, this injunction is saying, it's not saying that, you know, you've defamed someone, you've ruined their reputation, they can't get a job anymore, so you have to pay them $100,000 of lost salary. What this is saying is that you can't, in the future, you can't put up anything. Your speech rights are limited in advance.
Yeah.
And so
we don't like it, even though you haven't said it.
Howard Fox appealed this case himself. Very interesting. He appealed it pro se, you know, without an attorney, to the Fifth District Court of Appeals of the state of Florida, which found that this prior restraint that this judge had made in the order to be presumptively unconstitutional because it's the government, it's the court telling someone in advance, you can't talk at all or communicate at all on the internet about your community, which is a pretty remarkable limitation, right?
Yeah.
And so these injunctions against future free speech are just a classic example of the kind of prior restraint that runs afoul of the First Amendment. I think it's important to understand here what we're talking about in terms of the First Amendment in this case. What this case does not mean is that, it just does not mean that the homeowners associations are bound by the First Amendment. Because the First Amendment says something like Congress shall establish no law, or the General Assembly shall establish no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion or free speech or free assembly or this or that. It doesn't say that private contractual relationships or voluntary associations or mandatory associations that people enter into by purchasing property shall not limit free speech. So here we had, in this case, you have a set of governing documents, and you've got a settlement agreement where Howard Fox agreed to be limited in his free speech. And then you've also got this extra thing that was added on in this contempt proceeding that said, you shall not talk at all on the internet about your community. And that it's that last part where it's the judge stepping in and doing something that is not, where he's not just enforcing a covenant or a contract that ran afoul of the Constitution. I think that's just a very important point when talking about these things, because this case is not going to open up the floodgates in Florida or anywhere else for people to stop this, you know, flag displays or political signs or any of those things in some other under some other covenants. It's something. It's a very narrow holding where the court is acting as the state actor that is infringing upon someone's constitutional rights. And so I thought this was a very interesting case because it shows how perhaps this wasn't an infringement of free speech by an association, but it was free speech that was prompted by the requests of an association, you know, to a court that we'll see what happens with it. I think that what the appeals court is saying is not that this might not be. They're sending it back down to the trial judge to reexamine what he was doing and to determine whether or not he ran afoul of the First Amendment. So there's going to be further proceedings. I'll be interested in seeing what happens, if there's anything that comes out. Any subsequent opinions?
There seems to be this creep that I'm seeing across the country in terms of gag orders and curtailing free speech. You can't stand here and do this. You can't do that. I know of a case that we're going to be talking about hopefully one of these days where the association has asked the judge, even though it's not a final decision, has asked the judge to put a gag order on everybody so that they cannot talk about the case, what happened, and all of that. Why do we need gag orders if everybody's acting above the law? I mean, if everybody's behaving and doing what they're doing, why would we even contemplate gag orders, and why would a judge even agree to something stupid like that? John, this is happening too much. I mean, I've heard of homeowners who've had blogs or who've had newsletters or who've written something or done something where they've gone to court, they've been sued for $1 million, and they've settled. And you know that the association could never possibly win on that, but they've settled, and there's always a gag order. So all of a sudden, nobody can talk about it. So what's going on? Why is it that we have to control your house, the color, the shades you use in your windows, and what you say?
Very good question. I think it's a very good question for the folks that are asking for these kinds of gag orders, that they should have to answer those questions, because I can see how if people want to give up their free speech rights in terms of a contract in order to get some other thing, to bargain for something else, then that's something that they, people can put all sorts of things.
But if they understand what they're doing, that's okay. And if the deal is, okay, so I'm going to give up my right to free speech and I'm not going to talk about it as long as you mow my yard. But if you don't mow my yard, what rights do I have? I have to go to court to enforce this contract.
What I frequently see is that what's put into the settlement agreement has to do with the compensation that's received. Like the insurance company usually, or sometimes the board, doesn't want it to get out there that they settled this case for such a dollar amount, because then that sets a benchmark for future similar cases of what kind of settlement can be achieved. It kind of encourages people to go after them even more, right?
Maybe it would encourage them to behave themselves.
Well, the owner is getting something out of this, and they don't, being able to go around and tell everyone the amount that they settled at doesn't really, it doesn't mean much to them anymore, because they're getting the money, right? And if there's other things that are in the contract, if let's say that the contract, the settlement agreement, allows someone to get their property back because it was wrongfully foreclosed on, or requires that some changes be made to a common area to make them more safe or to stop flooding or some problem or something like that, people are going to know that there's something happened, because, look, you know, you file a lawsuit with 100 numbered paragraphs detailing all the wrong that was done, and then a confidential settlement was entered into, and then lo and behold, 90 days later, there's something happening on the common area that didn't happen before, and there's a bunch of minutes in the association's record that say that, you know, we approve such and such, or, you know, such and such is made a part of, is a resolution of the board. In most cases, the keeping the amount of the dollar amount of the settlement confidential doesn't prejudice owners. What the problem is that when you tell people that they can't talk at all about their neighbors or their board members or their property manager or anything having to do with their community on their Facebook page, because what good does that do? Like what?
Actually, I disagree with you in terms of the finances. Suppose you and I lived next door to each other, and I went to court, and or I ended up in ADR or something, and with a settlement, the board did something. I settled for a certain sum of money. Ultimately, it's going to be your dollars that are going to pay for that settlement, and you're not allowed to know what I got out of it, because they don't want you to know. But the fact is that you're going to pay for it, whether it's going to come out of the association coffers and it's going to result in a special assessment down the road, or it's going to be in increased insurance premiums. It's going to cost you, and you have a right to know what your money's going for.
Well, you have a good point. I'm talking about from a perspective of an owner who's going through these things, and
if you're an owner,
you're going through these things, and you have an opportunity to settle something, and somebody wants you to make the dollar figure confidential, then from their perspective.
I fully understand.
You see what I mean? Like that.
But from the perspective of the homeowners who are ultimately going to pay for it, they have a right to know that.
Well, they're going to know, because they're going to know that they're going to see in the budget that their insurance premiums or the insurance.
Yeah, but they don't know how much you got. That's the point. You know, the board is playing Russian roulette with your money, and you're not allowed to know. And that's what I object to.
Well, there's a lot of things that are kept secret.
I know, and it shouldn't
like
be.
Like salaries and, you know.
That I don't have a problem with so much. I mean, if you know the aggregate amount that goes towards salaries. But anyway, John, I've had so much fun.
Well, cool. This has been a nice hour or so. And I hope that one of these days, there some additional light is shown on these topics, and you know you've been waiting for 30 years on getting rid of these fine statutes, but you know I think that people are getting to the point that they're ready to listen.
I hope so. It's about time. Thank you everybody for joining
Please check
us.
Check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.